Good afternoon. Welcome to Conceptual Framework Roundtable in Tokyo. I'm Takuchi, board member. Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your time and your attendance. I'm quite happy to have a Conceptual Framework Roundtable in this Asia-Oceania office. ISD published a discussion paper in July, and the comment period will end 14th of January next year. So we have another more than a couple of months to go. I think this is a very good timing for us to see each other and exchange opinion. So I welcome your comment in this round table. Actually, our discussion paper covers almost everything about the conceptual framework, but for the sake of time, we narrow down topics. We will deal with three topics, that is measurement, and profit loss and OCI, and asset and liability definition, recognition and derecognition. So we are going to discuss based on the papers we provided today. However, if you have a time, we would like to cover other areas. So you can feel free to talk about anything you want, because this is the very early stage of the project, and we haven't narrowed down the issues. So you can touch upon anything you would like. Well, I just mentioned two things about this meeting. This meeting will be held in English. However, we are providing a simultaneous translation. So please do not be too fast. So that is one point. And the other thing is we are not going to take an official break time. So if you would like to take a break, please do so at your own timing. Okay, let's go through the self-introduction from Christy, please.
Hi, I'm Christy Robinson. I'm a technical principal at the IASB.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Mitsuhiro Takemura. I'm the director of Asia-Oceania Office of IFRS Foundation.
Hello, my name is Goro Kumagai of Mizuho Securities. Today, I'm not representing the preparers rather than the state. I would represent the only user for the session.
I'm Kazuo Iwasa from Fujitsu.
I'm Hiroshi Yamada. I work for Panasonic.
Hello, my name is Tomo Sekiguchi, a board member for the ASBJ.
Simon Riley from the Hong Kong Institute of CPAs.
My name is Takefumi Ueno. I'm from the University of Shizuoka. It's my teaching the financial accounting in the class.
Hi, I'm Akashi Kono. I'm from Ernst & Young.
Hi, I'm Yoshi Hasegawa. I'm from KPMG Atsusa.
I'm Nobu Kawanishi, Director of International Activities at the Accounting Standards Board of Japan, on secondment to the ISB, working on the Conceptual Framework Project.
Okay, and some friends from Korea will delay because of airport alteration. They are supposed to arrive at Haneda, but they arrived at Narita. So it may take another hour, so they will join in our time. So, okay, let's get started. So, Christy, could you kick off, please?
So the first topic we want to discuss is measurement, and that's summarized in Agenda Paper 1. And we want to, as part of this paper, in this section of the discussion, we want to get your reactions on Section 6 of the discussion paper, which is on measurement. And the first aspect of that I would like to discuss is the objective of measurement. And the discussion paper provides that the objective of measurement is to contribute to the faithful representation of relevant information about the resources of the entity, claims against the entity, and changes in resources and claims, and how efficiently and effectively the entity's management and governing board have discharged their responsibility to use the entity's resources. So for my first question is, do you think the conceptual framework should include an overall measurement objective, and do you agree with the one that we've proposed? Can I open that up for discussion?
Does anybody have any opinion? Who is going to break the ice?
Okay, first I'd like to welcome the DP discussion paper, preliminary view, which points out that the mixed measurement basis provides more relevant information than the single measurement basis. In this regard, I believe that conceptual framework should include an overall measurement objective because it should confirm the measurement must provide a faithful representation of the relevant information, which is unlikely to be achieved by the single measurement. And I do not see any problem with the proposed measurement objective. Thank you.
Sorry. Hello. Does anybody have any thoughts about having two objectives? Okay, shall we move on anyway? Yes, please.
Yes, I believe there were two questions. I would just like to address the first one at this point. Whether or not measurement should be discussed within the conceptual framework, I think the answer to that, at least from my perspective, is an absolute yes. And also, it was one of the major difficulties when dealing with the previous or the existing framework, where it only listed up certain type of measurements, and it didn't sort of describe what the objective was or what the preferences were. So the answer to the first question is probably a little more easier. Whether or not I object to or agree to what is proposed right now is more difficult to probably answer, because in a way there's not really much to object to, but partially I think that might be the problem. And the reason why I feel that is because probably in deriving what should be the most appropriate measurement, the discussion that leads that bit, I think, is still missing from what is in the existing discussion paper. So that might go beyond whether or not I agree with what is proposed right now in terms of measurement, but something that I will probably touch again later on.
Yep. And regarding the number two, that the I might be the minority, but I would support the ASB. We highly recommend the ASB's preliminary view on the selection of measurement. The measurement for a particular asset should be chosen based upon how it is employed by the management to obtain the future cash flow. Likewise, the one for liability should be chosen based upon how it will be settled. By saying that, I mean that reporting entities should be required in principle to choose the same measurement basis for a particular asset with a similar use. I believe this principle is very important for users to be confident when they compare the financial statements of different entities. For the purpose of comparability, I agree with the ISB to limit the number of measurements. Thank you.
Just to make a comment on the second question, I think I can understand the intention of the board. but we shouldn't be maybe reacted too much, overreact. I think from preparer's perspective, the measurement methodology should be maybe small amount. Some variation should be limited, but it's not necessary at this stage. We shouldn't limit the numbers of the measurement methodology. I think what Tomo and Simon said is pretty much similar. Even disagreeing the limitation, but while our intention is to keep the board to expand the variation of the methodology to the limited basis. But since we don't know the direction we're going forward, at this stage we don't need to limit the numbers. That's my point.
Perhaps what you said is in line with what the ASPJ are saying. So the number would be limited as an outcome. However, we shouldn't say in the first place to limit. Okay, thank you. Hasegawa.
Yeah, regarding the second question, we're still debating, but I think I agree with I agree that we shouldn't apply one single measurement basis to in all situations for all assets and liabilities. With regard to the question of whether we should limit the number of measurement bases. Maybe to determine what measurement basis would be appropriate under certain circumstances. The current proposed, it's getting back to the first question, the current proposed objective of measurement may be too vague, and if we wanted to be practical and workable as a principle, then I think it may be more concrete and specific, because the proposed objective, measurement objective, is currently quite similar to the objective of financial reporting itself.
Thank you. I've been thinking how to describe this, but probably it's very difficult for me to answer any of those questions because anybody in the right frame of mind probably wouldn't really say that one particular measurement would be appropriate in all circumstances. But when it comes to the question then how many or which, I think nobody really has an answer here. And my feeling is that it's because we're not entirely sure what we think financial statements should describe or express. So in other words, I think we've been avoiding the issue of what financial statements, what is performance, what type of performance are we trying to describe here? And unless we really, well, maybe not an answer, but until we really have a deep discussion on that particular subject, I feel it is very difficult to provide an answer to any of those questions, and also to put any sort of preference on any of the different measurement types. And I sincerely hope that we don't end up in a situation where we are trying to accommodate existing or expected future standards when we have this type of discussion, so that, in other words, we completely avoid any of the sort of more difficult discussions and just try to, using Simon's words the other way around, we try to build a key that fits the keyhole rather than the other way around. And I also have a little bit of concern in terms of having measurement types that, let's say there is something that describes an asset or liability's nature most appropriately. Let's just say that for the sake of argument. But if that logic is followed, wouldn't that lead to me having, that it is actually more better to have more types of measurement for each and every type of assets and liabilities. So if you go down that route, maybe if we end up the other way around, rather than limiting, but actually if we think that it is the best to have measurement types for every different type of nature of assets and liabilities, then actually the answer might be that we should have lots and lots of rather than limiting numbers. One last comment is that, but I think we shouldn't really forget the fact that we have readers of financial statements. So in other words, understandability should have a role in all this discussion, and that's why I feel that that unless you put some sort of limit or discipline around the usage of measurement types, I think we end up in a very peculiar world where you think that you've chosen the right measurement type, but actually you end up in it with a financial statement that nobody understands.
Can we move on?
Yes, let's move on to selection of a measurement. And the ISB believes that the relevance of a particular measurement will depend on how investors and or users are likely to assess how an asset or a liability will contribute to an entity's cash flows. Consequently, their preliminary view is that the selection of a measurement for a particular asset will depend on how it contributes to future cash flows, and for a particular liability, how that will be settled or fulfilled. And the tables in paragraph 11 set out how that's applied to different uses and fulfillments. Therefore, the question that I would like to ask, the ISB also notes that one measure may not always be relevant, so the board would need to determine whether that one of those measures should be disclosed or whether they should be separately presented in different primary financial statements. So the question I would like to ask is, do you agree with the ISB's preliminary view that the selection of a measurement for a particular asset should be based on how it will contribute to future cash flows, and for a liability, how it will be settled or fulfilled? And then if there are two measurement bases which would be provide relevant information, that the ISB could either disclose one of those bases or measure one in the statement of financial position and use a different measure to determine profit and loss. So I'll open that up for questions.
I generally agree with the preliminary view regarding the selection of measurement for particular assets and liabilities. However, regarding the table on the paragraph 11, I think that the full classification and the suggested likely measurements need to be revised. There are some cases in which assets have two aspects of using and selling. The entity holds an asset, but it might sell that asset. Examples of this case are investment property and strategic investment in securities. In these cases, I believe that from the perspective of financial position, they should be measured by current market price. However, from the perspective of financial performance, they should be measured by cost. In this case, the entity should use current market price in the state of financial position and use cost to determine the amount recognized in profit or loss, representing the difference between two measures in OCI. So I think the table of paragraph 11 should be modified to cope with the measurement of both financial position and performance. Measurement of
financial position and financial participant might be different. So this table should be modified to define to treat these cases.
Yeah, and that was a similar view that was actually raised this morning. That and you know these tables are a summary prepared for this discussion, and it's not necessarily set out that way in the discussion paper, and it has driven that additional question about if you do have two relevant measures, how they should be presented. But I agree that, I recognise that as raised this morning, if we did articulate in a table, we do need to think perhaps, or the suggestion is that we need to think about the two different ways that maybe certain assets, which were primarily discussed, assets or liabilities could be used or settled or fulfilled in the case of a liability. Yes, so Jeho, we're at question three in agenda paper one, which is about measurement. So we've already talked about the objective of measurement. So there was general support for the objective, though there was a sense that perhaps it wasn't specific enough or didn't really add more than the objective of financial reporting. But there was also more a concern or more a discussion about whether the discussion paper or the conceptual framework has to limit the number of measurement bases. I think there was a sense that the framework itself should, as an objective, want to should result in a more limited number in applying the sort of objective or the rationale for measurement. So that the limiting factor was more that the issue to be discussed. And then in question two, we talked about. I think that was it. Question two, yes. And single measurement basis, most people supported having a fixed measurement model.
I'm very sorry for being late. There was a flight. There was a problem with my flight. I was supposed to land at Haneda Airport due to congestion at the terminal. Our flight diverted to Narita Airport. it turned out to be kind of tragedy, so I'm very sorry.
Is Steve come along with you, or?
So maybe he will join shortly. Yeah.
So, Jeho, do you have any comments from Korea about the question that you have already missed? Or do you want more time to catch up? Maybe ask a question later.
Yeah. So, I generally support the measurement objective and categorization of measurement, and also the criteria for selecting measurement basis. Having said that, it seems to me there is a room for supplementing that discussion paper. In that sense, I would like to take issue with cash flow-based measurement. I'm not sure you already touched upon that issue or not. It's okay? Yeah, okay. So, I think we can approach cash flow based measurement in two different ways. One way is to estimate a single set of cash flow, and which is usually known as the most likely outcome. And the other way is to calculate the expected cash flows by using a number of sets of cash flows. It seems to me that these two approaches are slightly touched upon in the discussion paper, but I don't think they are discussed on full scale. So Sorry. I have to calm down. Let me think. We've only just started discussing this piece,
so we could open it up to the room and then come back when you get a chance to have a drink. So.
Yeah. So actually, these two approaches are not totally different. Totally new concept to us. Those two approaches are already explained in the individual standards. So when you look at IS 36, impairment assets, you find out the guidance on that matter in Appendix A. So in that appendix, estimating a single set of cash flow is referred to as traditional approach, whereas calculating expected cash flows by using a number of sets of cash flows is referred to as expected cash flows approach. So I think that guidance is very useful, but I'm afraid that guidance does not fit well in that specific individual standard. So having that kind of conceptual guidance on the standard level seems to be quite awkward. So I would have it on the conceptual framework level. So my suggestion is that the ISB should transplant the guidance in Appendix A of IS 36 into conceptual framework. Yeah, thank you.
I would like to start with appreciating the ISB's effort on the put on this section, and I think we have a lot of things to that we like or we are favor of. For example, I think if we take a look at the paragraph 13, I think it's the next section, but paragraph 13A, you said that what information that measurement will produce in both, you know, this 13A essentially said ISB should look at both income statement and balance sheet. And then following that, in a logical flow, I think the paragraph 12A holds true, because if you paragraph 12B holds true, because if you take a look at both balance sheet and income statement, and you could come up with the different measurement bases that are appropriate for the different purposes. For example, I think if you take a look at the appropriate relevant measurement basis for the, let's say, the financial asset that held for collection, but it might be entity might sell that, I think the ISB may decide that the appropriate measurement basis should be the cost basis for the profit and loss statement. However, while the relevant measurement basis could be the current measurement basis for the balance sheet. So I think if the ISB follow carefully this paragraph 13A, I think the 12B is the natural consequences. So I think the question about whether we will be supporting paragraph 12B is whether we will be supporting paragraph 13A. So therefore, on this basis, we very much agree and support paragraph 13A and paragraph 12B. And also, as I said earlier, we believe that the relevant measurement basis should be determined on the basis of the nature of investment. And following that concept, I think the paragraph 10, 11, and 12, maybe 10, 11, I think it's the fit quite well in that concept, because, although it's not identical, but the nature of investment would reflect how an entity will contribute the ultimate cash flows. So I think it's I generally agree that paragraph 10, 11 in this paper although I have a very small suggestion for the paragraph 10, which is the, which said that an asset or liability of that type will contribute to the entity's future cash flows, and it the term will might be replaced by is likely to, because it's a bit difficult to anticipate what will happen, but it might be appropriate to say it is likely. And on that basis, if you take a look at the table in paragraph 11, it said that, it essentially said that the entities, the relevant measurement basis could be the current measurement, current market price if the asset the asset contribute to the cash, future cash flows by selling that. And I think it's the term is likely well fit into this in determination. And also, if we take a look at the holding for collection, etc., as Mr. Yamada mentioned, there are two different objectives an entity could have in mind. And the notable, the very famous example is, as I said earlier, the IFRS 9's financial assets things. And so by changing the term, the term will to is likely, and then I think it's naturally that, it will be natural that we could come up with the hybrid type purposes in the in that table. Specifically, we think that there is a situation where an entity might sell or might hold for collection, or an entity might search for right to use, or might sell it. It is the common for the investment property. So these are to summarize, we support the ISP's proposal, and the paragraph 13, if we support paragraph 13A, we will be supporting paragraph 12B, and if we will be changing the term will to is likely, we will come up with the hybrid, hybrid category in the table of the asset and maybe liability.
Got no more? Yes.
I'm not quite sure why we decided that contribution to the entity's future cash flows should be the driver to decide the measurement type. I'm not quite sure where that came from is a question I have. It leads to my earlier question that I'm not quite sure what we think that financial statements should describe. And again, in 12B, we start talking about a divorce between the balance sheet and the income statement. Now, again, if that is based on a discussion where we know what the balance sheet should express and what we know the income statement should express, then I could follow that. But it seems to have come out of the blue, and that is slightly confusing to me. Having said that, I don't necessarily disagree to what is mentioned here, that contribution to the entity's future cash flows should be one way of looking at for the choice of measurement type. But having said that, there are small things that slightly bothers me. For instance, I'm not quite sure why, when using an asset, the cost is what best describes that particular asset's contribution to the entity's future cash flow. I mean, if I bought a piece of machinery and decide to make a product using that, I think it doesn't really matter how much it costs me to buy that particular piece of machinery. Now, I'm not opposing to usage of cost, but just the logic used here, it feels more like we're trying to get to cost in some way rather than using this driver to say that cost is actually the best way of measuring something that you are going to use.
Just to respond, the reason why the view that a particular asset should, the measurement for a particular asset should depend on how it contributes to future cash flows is because the objective of financial reporting embodies a notion that users need information to assess future cash flows. So therefore it makes sense that if you base the measurement of your asset on how it will contribute to cash flows in the future, it will provide useful information for users to assess that. So that's where the cash flow notion comes. It comes directly from the objective in Chapter 1 of the conceptual framework. I think, secondly, to your point about why do we think cost might be useful if you consume or use an asset, because often if you have a bit of equipment that you're using to produce a good or something that you want to sell, then you're interested in is the margin, so the difference between the cost of what it's used to create that say inventory or that item against what you can sell it. So that's why that margin and that consumption cost basis often provides relevant information.
But in which case, why wouldn't you include the margin in the measurement?
Because the margin is the difference between an asset or a revenue and a sale rather than the
why not use discounted cash flow?
For the margin?
Yeah, yes.
Well, I think that's projecting future sales.
There are lots of things that... for instance, if you take fair value, that incorporates a lot of future expectation, and I don't see the reason why when you're using that you have some sort of a reason to exclude that, and just to get that.
I suppose there's an idea that if you're going to use something, you're never going to realize perhaps what that future cash flow
is. So it's a matter of realization, is it?
No.
Well, again, if there is a reasonable explanation, I'm not opposing to cost or anything, but I just feel that even though you said that the overall objective of financial statements is to provide information in order to facilitate people to judge what they should expect from future cash flows, but I still feel that there is a slight jump from that objective to what people really are expecting from income statements and balance sheets. Because if there were no real queries there, I think a lot of things would be a lot simpler. So I do feel that there some discussion needs to be, some sort of bridging discussion needs to be done in order to more robustly say that this is what we think that contribution to future cash flows should be the driver to choice of measurement types.
Yeah, thank you very much. Your suggestion is very useful. But perhaps in this paper, we did not go that far. Probably we just said that when using, and you don't have any plan to sell, and so actually simply now using it, then we are saying that the most likely measurement, we are not saying that this is the best, but the most likely measurement would be the cost, because normally we do not know any other measurement tools, because you have no plan to sell it or you have no plan to dispose it, so you keep using it. So therefore the cost would be the best available measurement tool. Therefore we are saying it's likely measurement. But I take your point, so we have to think about the such deep discussion. Thank you.
I do think the way we got there is well articulated in the discussion paper, and I think it is covered when we talk right at the beginning of the chapter. So if that's not clear how we actually got to that, I do think we do take about 5 or 6 paragraphs to explain where we got from the objective of financial reporting through to the contribution to future cash flows. So maybe we could discuss later why we think that's not clear.
Okay, any other comments?
So if we move to the next question, actually, and given the time, I'll combine the last two questions, which is, we said that when the IFB's preliminary view is that when selecting a measurement, the IFB should consider both the impact on the statement of financial position and the statement and the impact on the statements of profit and loss and other comprehensive income, and also should consider how whether the benefits of the particular measurement outweigh the costs. And then, so I'd like your comments on that, but also any other comments you have on the measurement chapter.
I have one very small comment. Paragraph 14A, which talks about the measurement categories, and the IFB's preliminary view essentially categorized into three classes. One is the cost-based measurement, the other is the current market prices, market price-based, and the other is the last one in the cash flow-based measurement that Jaiho articulated well. With regard to the current market price-based, I think the term at least is confusing because it includes the notion of fair value, and the term current market price-based implies that only the level 1 or level 2 asset, will be embodied. So perhaps you could consider whether the other term, including current value-based, current value based measurement, etc., could be appropriate to describe what you're trying to describe. So,
I suppose it was current market price was any technique used to try and estimate a current market price, whether that's observable or not observable. But I take your point that it implies that there is a current market price of some description, rather than being a methodology to try and estimate that, whether that's directly or through models, etc.
Okay, shall we move on to... sorry.
So, are you speaking of other comments? Yeah, okay. So, I would like to take issue with foreign currency translation. Yeah. So I think we may need to examine the nature of foreign currency translation. Unfortunately, the discussion paper excluded foreign currency translation from its scope of measurement discussion. But having said that, it's not clear though what made the ISB decide in that way. Whether it is because the ISB think that foreign currency translation is not part of measurement, but simply changing numbers, conversion from one currency to another, or is it because the ISB still consider foreign currency translation to be a part of measurement, but it does not fit well into either of three categories set out in the discussion paper, cost-based measurement, or current market prices, or cash flow-based measurement. As you may already know, the ISB identified foreign currency translation as one of the research projects soon to be launched. In relation to that, the KSB also has been carrying out an extensive research work on its own for 2 years up until 2011, and we submitted our research outcome to the ISB. During that work, we felt that there is no firm ground on which foreign translation could be discussed further. So we hope that the firm groundwork could be laid before that research work. So in that sense, I have two questions. One question is foreign translation is measurement or not? If it is measurement, translating foreign monetary items by reference to spot rate, which is closing rate, is fair value measurement or not? If it is fair value measurement, it can be looked at in terms of IFRS 13. So I think answers to those two questions might be very helpful to lay groundwork for the ISB's research project on foreign currency translation. Yeah, thank you.
I think the fact that the discussion paper doesn't address foreign currency translation isn't really a decision or a view whether it's a measurement or not, and I think it's very much a broader question which we felt that we couldn't address in the time and the scope of this discussion paper, and very much a view of what is the nature of FX translation is debatable, I think. Some people view it as something that should go directly to equity, I think on the basis that it could be a capital maintenance adjustment. I think other do view it as income and expense. It is an issue that I think has not been addressed specifically in the discussion paper, and I think that's more as a result of what we could manage within the time of doing this rather than an assessment of what it actually is or it isn't. And I think then that goes to that we don't know the answer to your second question about whether that is a fair value measurement, because we haven't yet determined whether it is a measurement or not.
At least I can still hope for the discussion.
I have received a strong message. We've received the same message in this morning's roundtable that it's something that we should address, that there was a view that it should have been addressed in the discussion paper, so that will be fed back as part of this outreach.
Yes, I would like to reiterate my general support for the preliminary view on this discussion paper regarding the measurement. But the one thing I do not understand is why you are still, IASB, is hesitant to distinguish from revenue from gains and the expenses from losses, and fit maybe to distinction between net income and OCI. And I'm neither the professional accounting standard setters nor the theorist on accounting standards, but as a professional users, I think that this distinction is still very important. I have heard that it is very difficult to define these concepts, but at least the IASB should try to seek the possibility to develop these concepts. And I'm a bit disappointed that in the other section that you were just saying that the revenue and gains are basically economically the same thing, and the expenses and losses. But from that the investors or users' point of view, this looks different. I know that some users, there are many users regard these as the same, but at the same time there are many users who think that these are different. So
I think to be able to provide guidance on the difference between revenues and gains is requiring haven't got the definition of revenues, but it's something about the ordinary activities or business activities, the idea of it being an operating, maybe not so an operating, but in the business, the ordinary activities, and that's given that it relates to the activities of the entity specifically, that's very difficult to pronounce at a general purpose financial statements level. So it will often depend on the nature of the entity rather than something that we can define fully. Mm-hmm. So that's primarily the reason why we haven't defined it. Mm-hmm. So one company's gain can be another company's revenue, depending on the company or the entity.
Mm-hmm. I understand that, but still that we are using the business model for the IFRS 9 so that the business model on the management approach may provide some kind of insight to this solve that. But anyway, that I understand your current thought.
Just a short comment. I appreciate ISP's intention regarding the paragraph 13 to consider this net income and OCI when you determine the measurement. So I wish we could have some kind of simple notion that cost basis measurement change goes to P&L and fair value change goes to OCI. But things undergo such simple, and you can think, I understand that a lot of discussion goes on how you clarify that measurement basis relating to net income and OCI. So, considering establishing this robust borderline between the net income and OCI, maybe we can think, go to the seek for the route to the definition of net income could be the one possible opportunity. I think I hope ISP doesn't give up this route yet. So that's one comment. And the other one is looking at the paragraph 13b. This I appreciate this sentence that considering the cost. But I have a fear that this paragraph becoming meaningless because it is prepared responsibility to make it efficient production of financial statements. And we had a discussion of that this costs us a lot, prepares a lot to produce certain information, but analysts doesn't listen. Because the analyst observation is just trying to avoid disclosure, even if it's not the case. So I just want, and also I heard that impractical means impossible. Sometimes people might state like that way. It is a very, very difficult argument to become looking at the cost. So I just want to emphasize, I just want to request ISP to keep in mind this sentence becomes really live and considerable.
And it actually, even though it's stated here, it applies fully across the conceptual framework, that notion. There has been a point raised that we don't necessarily need it again here related to measurement, but it should be a concept that overrides the board's decision whenever they set any accounting standard across all subjects, whether that's selection of a measurement basis or recognition or any aspect of standard setting.
Then shall we move on to the next discussion paper?
So the next topic relates to agenda paper 2, and this is on presentation of profit and loss and other comprehensive income. And it discusses our chapter 8 of the discussion paper, which is on presentation or in the statement of comprehensive income. And the first response, and I know this discussion sort of melded this morning, and in terms of time, what I'd like to do is discuss two sections together. So the first section is regarding financial performance, and we've heard from some constituents that they would like us to define financial performance. The board felt that there are many different views of what price financial performance can be and where it comes from. What the board did think was that the statement of comprehensive income does provide information about that is useful for assessing financial performance, and that's in particular about the return the entity has made on its assets and liabilities during the period, and therefore is concentrated on how best to present that information that the statement of comprehensive income provides. And in doing so, the board determined that it should retain the concept of profit and loss because it gives a primary measure of that information, of that the return the entity has made on the its assets during the period. And so therefore, what the questions I would like to ask you are questions, I think it's one in the agenda paper two, which is the board does not, in the discussion paper, the ISB does not define financial performance. Do you agree with this? And then some people have asked whether we should equate financial performance with profit and loss. So that's another aspect of the question. And then also question two, what we have done is said that we'll look at the information that the statement of comprehensive income provides, and in doing so, we recognise that we should require a profit and loss total or subtotal. And do you agree with that decision by the board? So I'll open up those questions, which is questions one and two in the agenda paper.
I would like to respond to question one. ISB does not define the financial performance. I totally agree because it's not necessary defined that. Because what is the financial performance? It's difficult to define it. And I think the analysts and other users can judge the performance if the ISB prepares high quality accounting standards. It's not necessary to define.
Thank you. Firstly, we share the view that the financial performance should look like more holistically rather than just to include the particular line. So the financial performance should be determined on the basis of the whole information set. However, we are not in agreement with the question two, which is to propose that profit or loss should be as a just a subtotal or total. Although we agree that the profit or loss should be presented in the comprehensive state income. The reason why we disagree with that is we think that profit or loss is perhaps the most important indicator for users to assess the financial performance, and therefore the profit or loss is the essential information that users would like to draw from the financial statements. So if it's the essential component, why not define or place as the essential component that is the element, because the element said that it is the essential component of the financial statement, and so if it's the final profit or loss is so essential for users to understand, analyze the financial information, why not define as the other element? So we have a more reason, but I would like to cut off by my speaking, but we generally support that the financial performance should be looked at more holistically, but we firmly believe that the profit or loss should be defined as an element.
I think the reason we felt we couldn't define it as an element is that it's effectively a net number, so it's a number which combines both income mm-hmm. and expense. One thing that perhaps was raised for discussion and perhaps maybe another way to look at it, is there different types of income and expense? So is there profit and loss income and profit and loss expense, which is different from OCI income and OCI expense? But to actually define profit and loss as an element, I think we would struggle with.
Yeah, I understand your logic, but look at the equity. Equity is the just a residual number that is calculated on the basis asset minus liability. And well, the profit or loss, I could argue that it is the same construct with the equity. So, I don't like to spend too much about that. So.
And just in terms of some feedback, we have heard that request at other roundtables and outreach.
Yeah. I completely support Tomo's view. As a financial statement user, I do agree that the net income, both comprehensive income and as well as net income, are very useful indicators or the performance, the measure of the measurement of the performance. And I do agree that the net income is just one facet of the performance. And the users generally, look at the all possible available information to measure that the financial performance of the entities. So that the performance, it is very difficult to define the financial performance. Because that the users are using the different measurement, but still that the as a kind of standard or the as a kind of benchmark or something like that, I think that it is not a very bad thing for the accounting standard system to define some kind of financial performance, and also that the that the net income. EPS or PL or whatsoever is provides investors with very very cost-effective initial or preliminary assessment of the company's financial performance as well as valuation. So that the I have never seen that those people who never use a price to earnings ratio, which is based upon that EPS, among the investors. So the, of course, they are not saying, I'm not saying that the, EPS and PL is enough to suffice to value that certain entities, but still it is a very, good, probably the best initial gateway to assess the value of the company. So in that regard, I believe that the it is very good thing, or the, from even user's point of view, that the we need some kind of definition of net income. The comprehensive income is easy, but it is so difficult to define that the net income. But the, since we are using this concept, I think that most users. I'd like to reiterate, most users of financial statement around the globe use net income. So I think that the theoretical difficulty from accounting setup's point of view do not justify that the negligence of the definition of net income.
On this point, I just would like to go a little further. We have comprehensive income. And in a sense, comprehensive income is mathematically easy. It's just the difference between the change of asset and liability. And then in this concept of comprehensive income, we have net income and other comprehensive income. So the question is how we can cut the line between net profit and OCI. And our proposal is OCI should be the exception. that basically the net profit is the residual. So the reason why we said is perhaps it would be easier for us to know what could be OCI, because this is a peculiar thing which cannot fit into the performance notion. So that's why we are saying that. But if you say that net profit should be defined, then automatically OCI could be residual. Do you really think that is easier than what we are saying?
Yes, this should be the comment for the later questions, but this is my just, you know, first thought or intuition that, by defining accumulating OCI as well as retained earnings, probably that the definition of recycling or net income should become easier. You know, that I just feel that your proposal on the distinction of OCI is very complicated, and it is they are very hard to understand. And I'm afraid that some items, some classification items might be that used for that kind of discretionary reporting. I'll stop that. So at this moment.
Okay. I think we'll come back to that point. The next topic we want to discuss is recycling. So along with the idea that the conceptual framework should retain a concept of profit and loss, it's also important to consider recycling, whether an item which is recognized in other comprehensive income should be subsequently recognized in profit and loss. And the board's preliminary view to the reasons set out in for the supporting view in Table 2 was that it should retain the notion of recycling, but at least some or all items that were previously recognised in other comprehensive income should be recognised in a subsequent period in profit and loss. So I'd like your views on that that preliminary view of the board. And so that's question 3 of the paper.
I agree in that items previously recognized in OCI should be recycled. But however, my view regarding recycling is different from the preliminary view. In my view, all items previously recognized in OCI should be subsequently recycled. Without this mechanism, some items recognized in OCI are never recognized in profit or loss. In this case, all inclusive character of net income is lost. As a result, the usefulness of profit or loss as the most important indicator of performance would be significantly deteriorated. Considering long periods, the total of profit or loss should be equal to the total of cash flows. This is attained only by recycling all items previously recognized in OCI. Consequently, I do not agree with the treatment of non-recycling of some items of IFRS's. To attain the comparability of profit or loss, I also think that recycling should be required for the items recognized in OCI rather than permitted. Thank you.
Yes, I mean, I personally agree with that. You more or less in a situation where you have an all or nothing, depending on what you consider the profit and loss statement to represent. If you've got profit and loss plus OCI as sort of representing financial performance overall, then you should have no recycling. But if you've got, as I agree with my friend over here, the profit and loss being the primary representation of financial performance for a particular period, then anything that's sort of parked in the OCI for the time being ultimately would have to come back upon, I don't know whether you're applying a realization type of approach or some other criteria. But if you are, you know, I think this is a comment that was made this morning, partly in jest, but still a serious side to it. You know, we've had the term recycling around for 20 plus years. I can't remember exactly when, but it is at least 20 years. I know that. And you know, the whole notion of recycling is to say, well, we've already recognised it in our overall financial performance for the year, and we're kind of repeating it again, so we recognise it all over again. You know, I think that the ISB, if you are going to be looking at the profit and loss statement as being the primary indicator of financial performance for a period, and you've previously recognised something in what we currently call OCI, and you've, you know, at some later stage it then qualifies for recognition in the profit and loss, you really ought to call it something else apart from recycling. I think that's, you know, that's when people get a conceptual hang-up between trying to think of one thing and yet we're doing another.
Yes, exactly. It relates to way of thinking. So,
you know, and I think you're getting close to, I mean, there may be, you know, if every rule has an exception potentially, but it's either one or the other consistently, not sort of some sort of, oh well, we like to, you know, recycle or whatever other name you'd like to call it for certain items, because that makes us feel comfortable, and yet we don't sort of recycle other items because we're not quite you know, comfortable with that. You know, it's having a halfway house, and like you said before, coming up with the defining line as to what is appropriately parked in OCI, you know, at least for the time being, you know, and what the P&L actually represents for a particular period is that's the critical issue here.
Whether items in OCI should be recycled, I think it depends on what the combined function of profit or loss and OCI, and what different roles of each of profit or loss and OCI are, and that depends. That leads us to the first question of what performance is. And I agree with a comment that was previously made, that I understand it is difficult to define financial performance. It might be a practical solution to not to define performance, but the question of what performance is may need to be tackled, because it is a quite fundamental issue, and by defining financial performance, it may make it easier to discuss the related issues of, for example, profit or loss versus OCI, and recycling versus non-recycling, and maybe single statement versus two separate statements. And there was one question in the previous agenda paper whether we could use one measure in the statement of financial position and another measure in profit or loss. And that's related to a question of whether performance drives the changes in assets and liabilities, or performance is merely the consequential changes of assets and liabilities, or are they two different things? And I think the answer may depend on what financial performance is.
And I suppose I struggle because I don't know. I think of financial performance as what a user assesses. So they want information in order to assess the company's performance. I'm not sure it's the thing that the company gives. It doesn't say this is my financial performance. It gives indicators of what it's done during the period, certain information, and then the user can assess its performance. And so I think we struggled to say, well, the profit and loss is financial performance, or you could get financial performance from all aspects of the financial statements. So by saying defining financial performance as a thing, I think you're disregarding the way that users will use the information. So I'd be interested to know from you how you view financial performance and if you would like it defined or described, to sort of encapsulate what that is, because we struggled.
We're still debating on this subject, and we don't, I'm not representing a firm view of our network. But maybe one factor to consider is considering whose performance it is. What is from whose perspective performance is? Is it performance of assets and assets themselves, or is it performance of an entity and things like that, other factors?
Well, I don't think you necessarily have to call it financial performance. You could call it anyway. A lot of people in this room, I think, have expressed things like definition of net income. If that's a more appropriate wording, I think that's fine. I think what I've been hearing is that it's very difficult for us to find where the ISB is trying to draw the line between net income and other things. And a lot of people feel that net income should not be the residual. So if you're taking that notion, I think you do have to come up with maybe not a definition. I think you're absolutely right in saying that people have different views. Kumano-san said that. Wood-san said that. But I think to have that discussion and to, well, if you could come up with a working base, if you like, for the board to start when developing a standard, a tentative notion of net income, for instance, that might actually serve well in development of new standards, as well as improving the existing standards.
It maybe leads to, I don't know if we've finished this question, but it does lead to the next question, which is in the discussion paper we did, rather than defining or describing profit and loss, we have sought to describe other comprehensive income. And I think we did that because we felt that if profit and loss is the primary measure, then we would expect most items of income and expense to be in there. And therefore, that, as Tak said earlier, that OCI is the exception and perhaps the narrower exception, and therefore it's an easier job to describe that rather than describing profit and loss. And therefore, you know, we were concerned to a certain extent if we tried to define profit and loss, and we did give it a go, but not very successfully, that we'd miss something out. So we felt a view that most things we would expect to be in profit and loss, with OCI being the described exception, if you like, would be the way that we could go. So that's the approach we took in the discussion paper. So we'd like your views on that, if we haven't already discussed them, which we have a little bit. But
As I said earlier, that the defining, you're trying to, in a sense, define or, you know, they classify OCI, but it is still, you know, difficult to understand. I think it's a quite complex system, and there are lots of room for discretion. And as other people suggest, that I'm also supporting that the full recycling of all items, which was recognized in OCI. And the, probably that the life would become easier if, as I said earlier, that if we define that the accumulated OCI and or the, at least that we make that clear distinction between that AOCI and the retained earnings, that the recycling is just that the withdrawal or from or the transfer of AOCI to retained earnings. And I think that this information is very important for the users of financial statements because it indicates that the some portion of accumulated OCI converted into retained earnings, which is a more concrete number by telling sale or other disposal of assets or liabilities. And this kind of information would give us, provides us with some kind of insight that how the management would control the risks they are exposed. And the, if we are, we do not fully make full recycling, that the, we would miss that kind of information. And the, I think that the, if we pursue that direction, if you pursue that direction, that the, we do not need the definition or the distinction among the, you know, OCI. That's my, you know, that's my view as a professional financial statement reader, but amateur on the accounting standard setter.
Thank you. I think the in discussing the question four, I think the key is the interaction between the chapter of the measurement and chapter of the profit and loss and OCI. And because we already discussed that in the chapter of the measurement section, we said that the, you know, there could be a potentially the different measurement basis for the asset, for the asset liabilities, for the purpose of the financial position and the statement of the, you know, the income statement. So the, there could be a different basis for the balance sheet and profit, you know, income statement. And therefore, I think the, we acknowledge that the door could open at the measurement, we measurement, at the, on the basis of we measurement, the door of the, you know, OCI could open. And the question here is when that the door closes. And the, I think the, so the, so in so the firstly I think it is, you know, the importance of the chapter two chapter and the in answering the question the we need to find out the some triggering event when the door closes and the ASBJ is actually working on the how the door could close or when that the door could close. And so we'll be, you know, we will be submitting the paper for the next phase of meeting. So in that sense, as Akashi mentioned, that we hope that that will serve as a working draft or the, you know, potentially the starting point for the discussion to define what could be a profit or loss. And so that the OCA could naturally become the residual rather than making the profit or loss to be a default or residual category.
So effectively, the door opening is the determination of when you need a different measuring profit and loss.
Mm-hmm.
Is the reason the trigger for that, or is it the trigger for the recycling? It's the trigger for the different measuring profit and loss is the opening of the door.
Yeah.
Yeah. In simple terms, if the possibly the measurement basis for the balance sheet and profit or loss statement are different, the door opens and the door closes when the two measurement bases become the same, and the question is when does the, you know, the, when does the to the two measurement bases would be the same. And the very simple situation is the derecognition when asset be recognized, when liability is recognized, of course, measurement basis for the asset liability asset and the balance sheet and the profit or loss statement will be the same because it will be the zero. However, there would be cases where there could be a different situation where the door closes, and so we are finding out the language or words that could portray the situation. So so you'll see in a couple of weeks.
I just have one question to the Tomo's argument, and I do understand your point. When we need two measurements, then that's the door open. When we don't need two measurements anymore, that's the timing of door closing. So disposal of or the recognition is the perfect timing. I do understand that. But this is in terms of the measurement, I do understand. However, in terms of performance, I'm not quite sure whether this indicates the performance, because as everybody says, profit loss is the most important indicator of the performance. And then if door closes, two measurements will disappear. Eventually, that goes to profit or loss. I would say it's a recycle or not, but anyway, it's go to the profit or loss. Do you think this is the best timing for the performance for that period?
My answer is yes, because in the measurement chapter we talked that we need to look at the when considering the measurement basis, we need to look at both the income statement and balance sheet. And if there is a different measurement, there are different relevant basis for the balance sheet and income statement, or CRIs. And when the measurement basis would be the same, that is the point of time. I'm talking about how to measure asset liabilities, and the recognition is the timing when the asset should be measured at zero. So the performance should be measured during the period, because during the period, the measurement basis would be reduced to zero. So I think this is the time when the performance should be recorded.
Yeah, I do understand. Okay, then for example, if you look at the PPE, and we have a depreciation. One is a straight line, or the other is the diminishing balance. And also we have impairment. And then we have derecognition. So in case of the PPE, everything goes to profit or loss. And on the other hand, there are some cases where we recognize difference of the measurement in the OCI. And then question is, those OCI could be measured, could be allocated differently for each performance, like a depreciation. But because of the fluctuation, we didn't do that. But at the end of the day, at the end of the day means at the end of the derecognition, it goes to the profit or loss at the one time. So do you think that one-time recognition of profit or loss still relevant that performance for that particular period?
Yeah, I'd say yes, for the reason I stated.
Yes, I support the some of the view, and I believe that this OCI is recognized once before as a part of a comprehensive income, I think that the users would decide which line comprehensive income or net income should be looked at for the particular particular reporting period. And also that the, anyway, OC, when recycled, that the gain, some kind of gains or income should be recognized at one time. But the, at the same time, we would see substantial withdrawal from that the AOCI, which indicates that this, large recognition of income is rather the one time, not sustainable. So the combining these two information, we can easily judge that this one-time gains is one-time gain is sustainable or not. So that I think that it should be left to the user's analysis of what kind of a performance should be the appropriate when you look at the performance of a particular reporting period.
I think the ISP should develop the definition of profit or loss. In this preliminary view, you try to define the OCI and the desired goals to profit or loss. But in that case, I'm not sure that digital is relevant to the performance. That is the indirect method. That is an easier way, but it's not the best way. I think the best way to define the definition of profit, it's a difficult way, but it's an ideal, desirable way. And I have an impression in your discussion paper, like table 8.1 on page 158. It's something like showing it's very extremely difficult to develop a definition of profit or loss. And as you know, the FASB has developed some kind of definition, which is a kind of realization and including a notion of realizable concept. And as Mr. Sekiguchi pointed out, the ASB, they have tried to develop the definition of profit or loss at the discussion. Is that discussion paper? It's something like a wide notion of realization. I think the ISP should make efforts to try to develop this definition of profit or loss.
We did, table 8.1 sort of does detail some of the initial discussions we had with all board members, and we couldn't come to any resolution based on any one of these individually. And different board members would have different views as to which ones they preferred, but none of them were the silver bullet, we'd say in English. But I suppose if there was one that was simple, we'd already have it. But I think we found it very complex. So the final question I want to ask is question 5, and I'm actually already know your views here a little bit, but and I won't go through the detail of what's in the paper, but the discussion paper does put forward a number of approaches to describing what goes into OCI, I would therefore, and those are approach 1 where we prohibit recycling, approach 2A, which we viewed a narrow approach, and approach 2B, which is a broad approach. And I'd want to get a sense from you whether you support any of those approaches. If so, which one? And if not, what's your alternative? And if you feel like you've already answered the question, we can just move on.
I don't know. Anyone can correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the sense that it's leaning towards 2B. 2B. Broad approach to requiring recycling. If not in every instance, then certainly in the vast majority.
So you like the broad number of items which 2B provides that you prefer recycling in all circumstances, because there's under 2B you wouldn't necessarily have recycling, but we have heard views that people like the breadth of 2B but do want recycling.
Well, I think it's the sense that the profit and loss statement is the primary indicator of financial performance, and that items parked into OCI are really just holding items. You know, when OCI, well before it was called OCI, came about with IAS 16 revaluations, it was looked upon as an equity issue, that recognising that the equity holders in the entity had a greater interest, if you like, or that they had their interest revalued over and above what was necessarily recognised as income up until that point, and that it was a sort of like a ultimately it would be recognised in income as it was realised either through use or sale at some stage in the future, but for the time being, because of fair value differences, the equity holders had a much greater stake in the entity reporting than necessarily arose through accumulated profits.
So, on this very point, do you think it should go to OCI or it should go to capital directly?
Difficult question, isn't it? I mean, you know, if it weren't for you know, preparer groups primarily not wanting to have their, if you like, their performance measured through accidents of market, either through primarily through significant revaluation gains. And, you know, we're talking about investment properties primarily, but I mean, not necessarily, but you know, the stewards of the business didn't consider that was necessarily part of their actual active performance for the year. You know, if it weren't for that, you'd put all of this into one statement of profit and loss for the year, and it would all be in there, you know, arguably disaggregated, but basically you'd have a bottom line there that says, well, this is you know, the net change in the value of our business from one period to another, but you know, things haven't you know, and obviously this was part of the original proposal so many years ago, but things haven't worked out to be that way.
Actually, in this conceptual framework project, we do not really touch upon the capital maintenance issue. We stay as we are. But if you look at our Section 9, there might be the possibility that we are going to discuss capital maintenance issue with the OCI recycling issue. So what you say may indicate there might be some possibility that we should consider it together.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the general sense in the table is that people do not like the, you know, two people like none of approach A, approach 1, 2A, 2B, rather people seeking for different approach. That is the message I'm getting.
Yeah, I have the same impression as Tomo. And the, as Mr. Yamada suggested, that I prefer that the full recycling of all OCI items. And I think that your approach to distinguish three, you know, types of OCI is somewhat confusing, particularly that I really do not understand that the distinction between difference between the bridging item and the transitory remeasurement. And so it could be used that some kind of earnings management anyway. If we cannot define these. So I think although you are saying that the definition or the, you know, depicting that the some characteristic of OCI is easier to than that the defining net income, but I do believe both are similarly difficult. And anyway, that I think that I personally, that as I said, that the recycling is some kind of indication of the management to how they controlled the risks which they were exposed to by disposing assets or settling liabilities. They are reducing the risk exposure to that particular asset or liabilities. And depicted by that the realizing recycled gains and also that the withdrawal from AOCI. So that I think that this information, this kind of information is relevant all the way, all the time. So that I do suppose that the full recycling using that the kind of broad approach.
I actually think, from what I've heard, is there's maybe support for this idea of bridging, but let me not use the term bridging, but it's everybody supports this idea of having two measurement bases, one in the statement of financial position and another in the profit and loss. That seemed to be a support I heard around the table, which is effectively what we had described as a bridging item. And OCI bridges those two measurement bases. And you said about one of the issues about transitory remeasurements. When we say that we want a measurement basis in profit and loss, it does have to be a describable, discernible measurement basis within profit and loss. And there's some items that are currently split between OCI now, which that wouldn't meet. And so we do think that would give some restrictions. But I think if we limited the discussion to determine how to distinguish between profit and loss and OCI to these items we call bridging items, but where you have the different measures, then recycling is a direct or automatic consequence of the measurement basis that you've had in profit and loss. It's not an active thing you do. It's driven by the measurement in the profit and loss. It seems to me there was support for that notion around the table.
I agree with Mr. Kumarai's views. And in my view, the approach one is the worst. I think in my view, that it's the same as Mr. Kumagai, that the combination of approach 2A and 2B and all items of OCI should be recycled, and the scope is a broad approach. So I'd like to call this approach as approach 3. It is opposite to approach 1. I think this approach 3 is consistent with the approach of US GAAP and Japanese GAAP. So I think it's one of the important approach. Probably you should consider that approach. And in that approach, the all-inclusive character of profit loss is attained in this approach.
Where we struggled, and I think the main issue we had was around pensions and the way we report pensions, and that we struggled. There was a definite view around the board that people wanted the remeasurement of pensions in OCI, but for us that would be contrary to a view of a proper measurement base in profit and loss, the way that IAS 19 currently determines that. So therefore, that sort of dread led to the transitory remeasurement notion. I understand your view that it's under US GAAP, but I think we've also got to take into consideration providing a relevant measure and relevant information in profit and loss. And so, therefore, we wouldn't want to recycle or have a notion of recycling where it didn't provide relevant information or a proper measurement basis going through profit and loss. So that's a constraint I think the board was very conscious to make.
I think the pension is a difficult topic to treat, but in my view and in the treatment I've heard us, undergraduate also is not recognizing profit or loss. I think that's a problem. I think all items in OCI should be recognizing profit or loss. So I think the discussion point is when and how to recognize gains or loss in a profit or loss. I think the problem is that they are missing from profit or loss under current IFRSs.
I think it's finding a time when it would give you good information. That's what we struggled with. You could say it's the end of the plaid, but then you have a gain or a loss, and does it really add to performance in that time? You could do some sort of corridor method, but I think people view that doesn't give you a very good or relevant information. So those were the issues that we struggled with when looking at it.
How about using the timing of payment for pension expenses?
I suppose that doesn't hit profit and loss because it just hits the value of your pension liability. So if you pay, do you mean the company paying the pension plan, or do you mean if the company pays into the pension plan, then that affects the value of the pension liability rather than it's not a profit and loss entry. If you're saying when you actually pay out the underlying pension to the employee, then that's quite an operationally difficult thing to actually put into operation.
It's not too difficult operationally. The problem is that understandable or not? I agree it's very difficult to decide the timing of recognizing net profit or loss.
I agree with the narrow approach. I'm a minority. Because I'm not sure a broader approach will not enhance the relevance of profit or loss. And I think OCI should be limited of items. Because case is, you made 12, you said it's the results in less consistent treatment recycling. Consistent is more complicated than no recycling or all recycling option. It's very important because it's my only the academician or teacher. The frame I teach the OCI or recycling, it's very difficult to say that. Maybe I think I agree the recycling, but by recycling, I need to understand the final statement. It become to be more complicated. Yeah, I'm worried as a teacher and academician.
Yeah, on this very point, so actually we provided 2A and the 2B, and we didn't provide approach 3, which allows variety of OCI which will be recycled. So if we allow lots of OCI and if we ask everything should be recycled, don't you think the financial reporting would be too much complicated, like Mr. Ueno mentioned? Because for every kind of OCI, you need to define what is the right timing for the recycle. Otherwise, you cannot provide wide range of OCI. Yes.
I'm not sure whether you're asking that whether accounting standards could become more complicated or financial statements could become more complicated, because I think what you're saying, accounting standards, well, I think it depends on how to define the triggering event. So it might be complicated or it might not be. So.
We'd like to move on to Agenda Paper 3, which deals with asset and liability definitions, recognitions and derecognition. In the interest of time, we have 5 questions in the paper, but we'd like to separate it into 3 sections based on the 3 sections that we touch on in this agenda paper, sections 2, 3, and 4. The first thing I'd like to discuss is the definition of assets and liabilities, which relate to questions 1 and 2 in the paper. If you look at paragraph 10 or page 4 of the paper, we have a table that shows the existing definition of assets and liabilities together with the suggested definition of assets and liabilities in the discussion paper. The major change between the definition is that the board decided to delete the term expected from the definition. And the reason is that if this term expected is interpreted as conveying a requirement that the probability of an inflow or outflow must meet some minimum threshold, that the board was worried that it might exclude many items that are clearly assets and liabilities in the board's view. So with that, I won't do much explanation, but I just open up for discussion as to whether you agree with the proposed definition.
Go ahead.
Okay. Move on to the next part, which is additional guidance on the definitions. Today we'd like to talk about the liability definition, especially the obligations that are conditional on the entity's future actions. In page 6 of the paper, we have 3 views. The board presented 3 views in the discussion paper about how to deal with these obligations that where an entity has the discretion to avoid or depending on its actions, the outcome might change. There are 3 views there. I won't repeat them, but the board's preliminary view is to reject view 1. But the board did not reach a decision on whether they favor view 2 or view 3. I'll open up for discussion.
Including question 1 and question 2.
Well, I'll provide some comment to stimulate the discussion. We generally agree that the proposed changes to the definition of asset liabilities, especially because the economic resources defined in the way a right or other sources of value that is capable of producing economic benefits, and the term capable of is, I think, is the striking the good balance, could strike in the sense that the ISP is trying to achieve. So, well, personally, at least, I suppose the proposed definition of the asset liabilities. With regard to the B1 through to B3, the B1 is, in my view, the B1 is too strict interpretation. I know that there are much debate about the actual accounting standards development or interpretations committee debate about whether the view 1 or view 2, view 3 could be appropriate. But view 1 from my point of view, is too restrictive, and which doesn't, which is not helping the to achieve the portray the economic substance. So there's clearly the B1. I support ISPs rejecting the B1. With regard to view 2 or view 3, there are different views between the, you know, the view 2 and view 3, but from my personal perspective, the view 3 relies too much on the past event, and the past, defining the past event, or the, you know, finding the past event in the context of the particular liability is a very, well, I think I would say it could be very difficult, and so from to ease the interpret, you know, implementation, I think the view 2 is much easier to implement, and view 2 also provides some leeway for the ISB or interpretation committee to decide the appropriate balance. So I think the view 1, the view 2 is the taking view 2 is the appropriate way forward.
Any other comment? Yes.
Yeah, that the conclusion is the same as Thomas. I prefer view 2.
Mm.
But I thought that view 3 is less costly to implement. And view 3 looks more prudent in the sense that it includes, you know, that all the, you know, possible asset liabilities. But I'm afraid it may end up with rather too large liabilities. And from the view of a faithful representation of economic reality, I think that the view 2 provides us with a better picture of the company. And the practically unconditional, it is my only concern, but the practically unconditional seems to invite certain room for preparer's discretion. I think, though, that it is an avoidable cost for the management approach.
I echo Tomo's and Mr. Kumagai's comments, but still not determined yet, but I'm leaning toward these two. I appreciate the board kind of disagreeing W1, since as a member of the IFRIC, I had a good discussion of the IFRIC 20, actually. And I know there were various support of that interpretation is too strict. And I appreciate the direction should be more practicable or judgment based on whatever the information available. So, but view 3 and 2, even I kind of need to read 2, but I can understand that practically could be simpler for view 3. But I think it's a judgment is required. Sorry, in principle. And just a few short comments on the back to the question 1 and 2 definition. I really basically support the views of the board, although I have a reservation of that next one with recognition we can talk about later. Thank you.
So you are a member of IFRIC, and recently IFRIC issued IFRIC 21, which is based on view 1. And that indicates that most IFRIC member interpretation of our definition is view 1. But as we know, there are other views in the different accounting standards. So could you quickly recap what was the discussion in the interpretation committee?
Well, I think view one is basically the notion of the IS 37, actually, the interpretation. When it's at least an obligating event happens when. The discussion, well, actually the interpretation is series of obligating events happens. The trigger of recognizing liability has to be the last event happens. So that is actually the view one. So proper interpretation of the IS 37 should be this. So that is no doubt about that, that based on the current standard setting. But that doesn't actually, question was, that information is useful to the users. That's a big debate occurs, and including myself, that some members disagree with that proposal or finalization.
We're still debating on these issues, but I agree with the proposed definition of assets and liabilities that does not retain the notion that an inflow or outflow is expected. With regard to the three different views regarding obligations conditional on the entity's future actions, I agree with the board's preliminary view to exclude view one because it would not really represent the economic substance of the situations. And between view two and view three, I'm leaning toward view two. I think view three would be too broad. And one thing I'd like to comment is that one thing that could be made clearer is how the principle underlying view two relates to the discussion about the constructive obligation and economic compulsion. Because in the discussion paper, it stated that economic compulsion in itself does not create a constructive obligation. And it's difficult currently in the discussion paper how to reconcile that statement and the principle underlying view two.
I generally support view two. I don't agree with view one because it's too strict. And regarding view three, it is comfortable with the pension accounting. So if you can develop a view which has some concept of view three, it's very good. But I think that you need to consider the conceptual fairness needs such detailed guidelines. So if you can develop a wide general concept, it's okay, but it's difficult. Another solution is not to include the views regarding conditional obligation in the conceptual framework.
So would you not? We found it was an area where there's, well, at least currently inconsistency in the way it's applied, so I thought it might be useful. But I do think we actually asked that specific question, so it's interesting to know that you prefer not to have it in the conceptual framework.
The next thing I'd like to discuss is recognition and derecognition. In terms of recognition, the board's preliminary view is that an entity should recognize all assets and liabilities that meet the definition, unless the ISB decides at the standards level that providing information about those items are not relevant or are not a faithful representation. In terms of derecognition, there is no reference in the current conceptual framework. The ISB preliminary view is that basically the derecognition should be a mirror of recognition. So because the recognition is based on the control approach, that would be used for derecognition. However, in cases where the entity retains control of a component of the asset of the, or the liability, the board's view is that it would determine the standards level how to best to portray the changes that resulted from the transaction. That means the DP discussion paper discusses several ways to do that, but one of them might be not to derecognize and continue to recognize the assets. With that, I'll open up for discussion.
I do not agree with the preliminary view on the recognition of assets and liabilities. I think the recognition criteria under the existing conceptual framework is better than the proposed recognition criteria. I believe that the probable condition stated in paragraph 18A is essential as the recognition criteria. Under the proposed recognition criteria stated in paragraph 20 and the guidance stated in paragraph 21, I am concerned that more assets and liabilities might be recognized compared with the recognition of assets and liabilities under IFRS's. The recognition approach stated in paragraph 20A might not be operational. And paragraph 21C states that recognition might not provide relevant information if identifying an asset and liability is unusually difficult, showing the case of intangible assets. Under this proposal, intangible assets, including internally generated assets, might be recognized as assets. I'm concerned that if identifying them are not unusually difficult.
Just can I make clear, so you disagree with our recognition criteria, but although we didn't really discuss the question one and two, do you not agree with our proposal of changing our definition?
Oh, I agree with the present review of question one and question two. I don't agree with question four, the recognition criteria.
Right, so may I understand in this way, so current definition must be changed, so probability threshold should not be included in the definition. However, in the recognition, threshold should be changed. I'm a little bit confused.
Are you going to change the probability threshold?
Not exactly. So we relocate. What we are proposing, we do not include expect or such kind of inflow wording into the definition. But we don't think it is the right place to put. But instead, in the recognition, perhaps could be a part of the measurement. We take those things into consideration.
Whether you have a threshold of probability or not, I think the notion of probability is very important for recognition.
And do you think that should be exactly the same as what we have today, or same as today?
Yeah.
Do you have any other comments? Yes.
we do understand the current problem of the using the probability threshold because there are situations where written options, especially the out of money written options, are recognized in the financial statement. And we, well, from the standard setting perspective, we need to so to say justify, or we need to at least we need to provide justifiable basis for recognizing the written option if it is the if reflects the economic substance appropriately. So we understand the problem, but we also understand the, as Mr. Yamada says, there is a much role that is played by the probability threshold. And so we're thinking about the classifying the situation where probability threshold is still necessary, or the situation where the probability situation shouldn't be appropriate. And for example, if there is a situation where the probability distribution is known to the third parties, especially in the case of the, for example, in the case of the lottery ticket written options that is sold in the market, in that cases, we do not think the probability threshold is necessary because everybody knows the probability, you know, and in their mind, and so the measurement should reflect the measurement play a role much more in that circumstances. However, when speaking about provision, recognized provisions, we still think that probability is maybe desirable threshold. Particularly looking at the paragraph 20 and 21, well, I have to say 20 is just essentially the nothing. It's just if the information isn't relevant, or information isn't reflecting the face of the representation, it shouldn't be recognized. And I think it's directly drawn from the objective of the financial statement. And so we think that paragraph 20 is essentially saying nothing. And well, the important role is played by paragraph 21. But paragraph 21 says that uses the term might. To say that the conceptual framework could provide further guidance to help the ISB to assess when recognizing an asset liability might not provide relevant information. And might is very weak terminology. Of course, there might be a situation where this isn't the case, or there might be other situations then that couldn't hold true. So I think they will... At least that they're using the term might in this sense, it isn't providing the sufficiently robust guidance for recognition of asset liabilities. So to summarize, I think we acknowledge the problem in the current framework, but we do think that we are exploring how to categorize the situation where probability thresholds could play the role as is the current framework.
Yeah, so I do understand your point, but the reason why we struggled with the probability threshold is there are cases that there is a probability, however, the outcome could be extreme, and then if we depend on the probability only, that does not provide good information. That is written in the paragraph 21A or paragraph 21C. There is a cases that, in a sense, reliability, it is quite difficult to measure the situation. So, therefore, the reason why we take away probability from the definition and then we stipulated the paragraph 20 and 21 is because there are a variety of situations, and that the ultimate purpose is a relevance of the information. So that is why we described in this way. But do you still think the probability comes first?
I'm not saying that probability should come first all the situations, but
Looking at the paragraph 21b, it says that if an asset exists but there's only a low probability that an inflow of economic benefit results, and the paragraph 21b uses the term probability in a different way than the current framework. And so although we acknowledge that ISB still want to use the term probability, I think there is a different consequences using the probability in the following the paragraph 21b. And so we are trying to develop some flowchart to illustrate what situation it might work and what situation it might not work. So we are in the course of the working on that.
So actually I'm with Tomo-san. So how to explain in discussion paper is a bit ambiguous. So I'm quite confused. So actually I think we have to answer this question, simple question. Do we still have explicit recognition criteria involving probability threshold? Actually, I thought it does not. So I'm a little confused.
Is that the question?
So my question is, do we still have explicit recognition criteria involving probability in the name of relevance? So that's quite confusing.
Tomo's and your point is that there's an implicit probability criteria if by what's described in paragraph 21, because it's talking about sometimes you might consider it, the board might consider it when determining whether to recognize an asset or a liability.
So it sounds like it is not explicit recognition criteria. No. You sometimes consider it.
I suppose that jump in. But the view is to take out the probability criteria. But the point raised just now has been that actually by referring to situations where the board might consider that recognition does not give you relevant information, one of those criteria actually does bring in a sense of probability. So I understand the confusion, but I don't think there was a view that we would have a probability criteria, but reading 21B in particular, you could say that there might be some sense of probability in there. I don't know, Nobu, if you want to add anything to that.
That's my understanding,
I generally support the definition of asset liability to exclude that the notion of expectation and also that the probability. But regarding the recognition criteria, as the colleagues here suggest, that I'm afraid that the new recognition criteria or that the criteria for not non-recognition or something like that is too broad. And I think you are saying that you will supplement that the guidance on that the standard by standard basis. But my concern is that the guidance for that the particular standards might be very large one. And also that I think that my concern is that the asset and liability, recognition criteria of asset and liabilities should be depend upon each individual standard under the new regime, that the consistency among the standards might be blurred. So that I think that from the point of view to develop new standards, that this new recognition criteria may give that the ISP more, you know, discretion of freedom. But the, that means, though, that I'm afraid that the decrease in the predictability or that the how what kind of standards you would develop. So that after the experiencing that is some kind of so-called tail risk during the financial crisis, I think that probability threshold may not be enough. So that some kind of materiality or something, the concept of the materiality might be needed here.
I would think the concept of materiality applies broadly. It's already in the conditional framework.
I just want to add, I have a concern of just removing that probability notion from the recognition. I can understand make it clear the definition to removing that probability, easy to understand, but I'm still have come to the conclusion whether probability should be included or not. But just looking at the paragraph 20, people read that entity should recognize all its assets and liability. If the conceptual framework say this is a great fear for preparers. We have to recognize everything. That even though the definition of assets and liability is defined, but we have to do some whatever, identify all the assets and liability, and go to the measurement phase for that, whether how much, and then we should categorize it as some balance sheet or notes or doesn't recognize or doesn't write anything or zero recognition, which is not kind of I haven't, maybe it's just a good usefulness. I mean, if this might be possible to get used to this, that kind of my consideration process, but it's a kind of quite new procedure, and I think it's just a kind of raised that concern about we have to do something more to add some measurement procedure in addition to that current process. So that is, I think, the biggest concern. If the board doesn't intend to do so, I think that the description needs to be maybe clarified.
Oh, yes. I actually liked this when I first read this. Simple, theoretically pure, easy to understand. But as Yuasa-san said, when I imagine if this recognition criteria is applied rigorously throughout standards, then I can imagine a whole host of new stuff coming onto the balance sheet, and it did kind of give me some goosebumps. But having said that, I think the way it's constructed is very neatly done. However, in terms of derecognition, nobody's touched this yet, but where you retain some part of an asset or a liability, I struggle to understand where you draw the line between whether if it's a derecognition recognition issue or if it's a unit of account issue. So I would prefer if those two were discussed together in a way. I guess that's it.
We did receive similar comments from other outreaches. The discussion paper deliberately said that we will not discuss the unit of account issue. And we, especially when we talk about derecognition, we are talking about two different units of account. So they are interlinked, and we'll take your input back to the board. Thank you.
Okay. Then shall we talk about other issues quickly? we discuss mainly three areas, but the conceptual framework covered other areas too. And in the section one, we talked about the general things and the purpose of the conceptual framework. And in the current conceptual framework, it has a lot of purposes. But in the new proposal, we rather concentrate on the board use. I mean, conceptual framework provides the kind of consistent basis for the board to develop the standard. And of course, other users of other readers of conceptual framework can refer the conceptual framework, of course, but the main focus is board use. That is one thing we mentioned in the section one. The other important part is the section five, which is the distinction between liability and equity. And in this section, we proposed a little bit new things. We had a long debate about the distinction between liability and equity. So in this conceptual framework, we propose to stick to the liability definition first. So we stay on liabilities definition, and then residual is equity. But in this equity, we will propose some classes. And for some classes, we would require update. So that is a very unique point of this conceptual framework. And the measurement difference should not go to profit or loss, but it should go to the statements of equity. So I would like to welcome any opinion if you have on this proposal shown in the section 5. And also we have section 7, which we talk about presentation and disclosure. And in this section, we make clear the difference between the presentation and disclosure, and we try to clarify what should be disclosed in the on the face and what should be on the note. And also we have section 9, which covers other miscellaneous things. But in this section, we touch upon some very contentious issues. One is the prudence issue, and the other is reliability issues, and also stewardship issues. So those are the contentious issues, and if you have any opinion on those issues, please raise it. And finally, we have other things like capital maintenance and unit of account and business models. So we do not have a lot of time, but any point, I would like to welcome any opinion.
I have two comments. First comment is regarding section 5, equity. So it's you have proposed a new proposal. I'm not comfortable with that new proposal. The preliminary bill requires the update the measure of each class of equity claim at the end of each period and recognize update to this measurement in the statement of changes in equity as a transfer of wealth between class of equity claim. I do not support such a big change regarding the accounting and the disclosure of equity. I think it's still too early to include such a discussion in revised conceptual frameworks. As you know, that it's a discussing a project of distinction between liability and equity. And I think the related party has not reached consensus in that project. So in that situation, it's too early to include that new concept in this revised conceptual framework. And my second comment is regarding Section 7 presentation. And in the paragraph 7.3, you discuss the agenda consultation regarding the request of cost and benefit consideration. But I couldn't find the discussion of cost and benefit consideration in your discussion paper. I think that's very important. It should be included in this discussion paper. Okay. Thank you.
I think it wasn't included because of the overall concept of a cost-benefit analysis in the conceptual framework, and whether sort of had a sense that if we discussed it in more detail, I'm not sure we'd add much more conceptually to the already concept of cost-benefit. But if there's specifics that you think would add in particular to this chapter over and above that concept, it'd be good to know what those are. So good thing to comment on.
I think even if it's including other overall discussion paper, the cost and benefit consideration is especially important for disclosure. I think that should be discussed in this section.
I take your point, yes. And Section 5. I do understand it's a little dangerous to make a drastic proposal in this conceptual framework. However, is there any other opportunity for us to propose some idea which could solve equity liability issue? Because when we discuss equity liability issues, we always face the conflict between conceptual frameworks. So that is why we brought it in the project of conceptual framework. So if you say so this is not the right place to discuss, then what is your plan when we should discuss? In what way?
About discussing a study project of such as standard level discussion, you need a much preliminary study for this topic.
Mm-hmm. I suppose there's also a lot in Section 5 that will not be in the conceptual framework, and a lot of the discussion about the remeasurement, etc., is trying to illustrate a possible way to pull the pressure off the line that's drawn when you distinguish between liabilities and equity. So I think one of the key decisions is what is how do you define equity? Is it the residual after taking away the liabilities? So I think that's definitely a conceptual framework discussion, because that will then drive the direction of any standards level project. I think to what extent we then include a lot of the other discussion in the conceptual framework about the remeasurement, I think is less certain. This was a lot about trying to give an illustration for what the impact of the decisions, the preliminary review that we should have a equity as the residual after deducting the liabilities. One way to sort of knowing that, it means that a lot more will flow into equity, and this was a way to demonstrate actually, even if that's the case, there is a sense that you could bring a lot of information that now may sit in the equity section. You could sort of disclose that quite prominently. But so I suppose your point is that you don't need to go that extra step in the conceptual framework, you prefer that pushed down to the standard.
Well, with regard to their Section 5, I think the Japanese stakeholders are a bit confused to see maybe significant changes proposed in the discussion paper. And not only the significant changes, but also their concern is the whether objective is right. That is, you know, the proposed objective in the Section 5 is right or not. And in my understanding, the Section 5 is trying to reflect the balance sheet leverage, and also to reflect the effect of dilution in the balance sheet. But I'm not sure whether the effect of dilution is the right objective in discussing the separation between liability and equity. Dilution, the effect of dilution is, I think, is disclosed in the per share, you know, the EPS type information, etc. And from our perspective, it is more important to draw a line in accordance with whether the transaction should be accounted for the equity transaction or whether the effect of transaction should be accounted for in the profit and loss. So when we talk about the split between liability and equity, we have particularly two things in mind. One is whether the effect of transaction should be accounted for equity transactions, other equity transaction, or should be accounted for in a profit or loss. And the other is whether the balance sheet reflects the solvency or liquidity of the, you know, liquidity type. And the effect of dilution, we do not think it's the primary objective in discussing whether how to separate the liability and equity. So I think that this is the reason why the Japanese stakeholders are a bit confused to see the proposal proposed in the discussion paper.
So I suppose it's a similar point. You would have preferred the discussion paper to almost stop at the question as to how to define equity versus a liability?
Well, I'm not proposing to stop it because I think, you know, it, from a standard set of perspective, it's very difficult and challenging, but it's important area for us to resolve. So we're not at all suggesting to stop the discussion. However, I'm saying that the objective is, I'm questioning whether the stated objective in the discussion paper is right, and from my specific perspective, it's wrong. So maybe the ISB could consider part about whether you've got the right objective in furthering the project.
I suppose there's two objectives. I think one to sort of give a principle behind what is distinguished between a liability and equity, and I don't see. You don't disagree with that step. But then I think the next point was not so much to say that the objective was to give information about dilution, but the fact that there's a lot of pressure put on whether something's equity or a liability. One, because you don't remeasure the equity, and therefore information about the changes in value of that equity up until perhaps settlement are not known. So whether if you provide more information about that during over its life, maybe the pressure on whether you distinguish between liabilities and equity is less. I think that I didn't necessarily think that it wasn't purely to provide information about dilution. It was to provide information more generally about those types of instruments over their life to effectively bring it to the same level of information which you get about liabilities, but which may economically be very similar if they're dealing with or relate in some way to the entity's own shares that may be cash settled, for example. So I think that was the objective rather than necessarily purely a view on dilution, but it is an end result.
Any other comment?
Okay, regarding Section 7 of the presentation versus disclosure, I generally support the proposal here, but I'm wondering if you could give us some suggestion about the distinction between the disclosure in notes versus, not the presentation, but versus the disclosure in non-financial information. I think that this is very difficult from the standard setter's point of view, but still, you know, that in many cases, I find that the preparers could provide us the relevant information, not unaudited relevant information in the you know, kind of the communication. So that the inner principle, the communication principle, you may suggest, I hope that you may suggest that the, you would suggest that the, some kind of guidelines, in what cases the, what kind of information you, that the preparers should provide in the notes, and in the, whereas that the, what kind of information should be provided in the, you know, non-financial information. This might be the kind of beyond of the scope of IASB or accounting standard, but still, I think that this kind of distinction is very important. If that this is the financial reporting.
I think there was an attempt to do that, and I think it's perhaps, I'm not going to question, but I think we've heard different views as to how successful it had been, and that was in Table 57.1, where it tried to describe what type of information you would see in the notes. And granted, that's quite general, but I assume maybe you're after something a bit more specific.
I'm the member of the committee, technical committee on the revenue recognition, that I found that there are disputes over the you know, reconciliation table for the revenue recognition. I think that this recognition table is very informative, but at the same time that I found that many preparers are insisting that they could provide similar information non-financial. And the, you know, from user's point of view, that the important thing is the timeliness and the content of the information. And the, here that we may not need accuracy, assuming that the preparers are quite honest. So I think that disclosure in non-financials might provide a good compromise between the user's needs and the preparer's ability to provide the timely information on with less costly basis.
So do you think we should address kind of non-gap measurement?
Yes, so that this should be that the agenda for the disclosure project rather than the conceptual framework, but still that the some kind of, you know, that the distinction or that the burden sharing between the conceptual framework project and the disclosure framework should be addressed, at least in the conceptual framework. You know, that I'm not saying that the conceptual framework should deal with this problem, but still that the, you know, that there's some kind of clear distinction between the disclosure project and the conceptual framework is needed. That is my feeling.
Just for me to clarify, when you meant non-financials, I took that to mean disclosure outside of the financial statements, so something in the management commentary or in the earnings releases, things like that.
Yes, exactly. You know, for example, that the Japanese companies are providing us with some kind of order inflation and order balances information, which is non-GAAP measure. And that these information are very, very useful for us. And the
the preparers could provide just this kind of information with, without getting any, you know, auditing. And in many cases, these kind of information may suffice for the user's analysis of the performance of the future cash flow of the company.
Yeah, just quickly, the difficulty of non-GAAP measurement is actually, it is quite difficult for IASB to provide those other information you should provide other than financial statements. And also, we cannot guarantee any comparability, or we cannot guarantee the quality of the information. Having said that, we do understand the usefulness of non-GAAP measurement and the efficiency of the non-GAAP measurement. So if we could provide some idea of useful non-GAAP measurement, which could be a supplement of the GAAP audited financial statement, that would be very useful and would be helpful for us to make our financial standards. So do you think such kind of comment could be stated in the conceptual framework or other disclosure initiatives?
Yes, I think that it should at least be, you should have some, you know, comments or insight regarding this topic in the conceptual framework. Although while you may make that the, you know, provide more insight on that the other project like disclosure, but still that I think that this is very something like very conceptual, so that the I don't think that the conceptual framework should just neglect that.
I think it goes a bit to the scope of this discussion paper and this project, which is financial statements, even though the conceptual framework is for financial reporting. And I think the, perhaps like with capital maintenance, that idea of what other information is beyond financial statements almost sits in a separate project about within that general financial reporting world. But I think it will be informed by some of the work that we do also in this disclosure initiative.
Yes, I do understand your point, but still, you know, while you are determining your scope of the financial statement, practically you are determining the, you know, distinction between what should be reported and in the financial statement and what should not be reported in the financial statement. But still that you can give us some, you know, that your idea, what should be reported in the total communication of the company.
We will try.
I do understand how difficult it is. You know that this is clearly not the accounting standards, because I'm talking about the outside of the accounting standards. But still, that I do believe it is very important to communicate better to investors and users and prepare us to communicate better.
Okay, thank you very much for giving us very important thoughts, and I think we got a lot of suggestions, and we definitely would like to reflect those suggestions into our consideration. And also, we are waiting for your good comment by the 14th of January. Thank you very much for today.